Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 11:45 p.m. and that is Pacific. Well, no, it isn't. It is Eastern Standard Summertime, and I'm currently in Florida. It's taken me an awful long time to get here, and there were some significant delays along the way, which has delayed the posting of Comment of the Day in here today. It's a bank holiday tomorrow in the UK, and again on Monday, and we've historically always held the UK holidays, so the next update for Comment of the Day will be on Tuesday. Well, I thought in kicking off with the big picture today that there is something that's been at the back of my mind for the last couple of days has been the fact that the total assets of central banks have continued to contract. They're back now where they were in November. And yet the stock market is at new highs. That's a very different condition from where we had it back in November. So there's obviously been a change. It's certainly a change more in terms of perception than actually what's been happening to central bank balance sheets. So the Federal Reserve has stopped reducing the size of its balance sheet, but they're certainly not adding to it yet, although that is quite possible just by the normal course of events to start again by the end of the year. And when we look at what's going on in China, they're not engaged in quantitative easing. This measure of central bank balance sheets is a quantitative easing measure because it's all about the amount of money that's getting printed by central banks. What China is currently doing is engaging in fiscal stimulus. And that doesn't show up here. I'm going to have to come up with a different measure, and that's not something that I have been able to devote sufficient time to yet, but it is certainly something that I intend to get done over the course of the next few weeks, is try and come up with some way to measure fiscal stimulus. So what we are perhaps witnessing, in fact, is the transition from overt monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus, and that is part of the reason why the stock market has been doing better. But at the same time, we also know that $1 trillion has been taken out of circulation over the course of the last 3 months. The entire pop on the upside from that began in November has now been erased. Europe is still engaged in its LTRO program, and they are still buying the bonds of the various constituent members, at least on a as each of the maturing bonds in fact mature, they're going on buying more. I think it's quite likely that Europe is going to engage in additional stimulus. Whether that is in fact going to be in the form of quantitative easing or a potential even breaking of the fiscal compact is yet to be seen, but quantitative easing looks much more likely. I saw this graphic in here today, and sorry, that's not the right that's not the right thing that I'm looking for. I'm going to have to minimize the audio recording so I can find it. I thought this is one of the most interesting graphics I've seen in a long time. It's from BlackRock, and it gives us a very clear cyclical perception of what we can expect from credit in the cycle. And we're at the point in Europe now where you're starting to get rising supply, and that generally translates into rising demand. One of the things that really stuck in my mind from my visit to London, for David's, well, the unfortunate circumstances of David's funeral, was meeting one of my old colleagues, who's now a portfolio manager at a Swiss firm, and he was saying that of the analysts he talks to and the research that he's exposed to, that India tends to get more exposure and is better covered than Europe is. Well, Europe is obviously a much more substantial investment location, and yet it's gone nowhere for the better part of 20 years. And that's, I think, a very, very significant fact. This is not the index that I had wanted to pull up. When we look at the Euro stocks, this is just the European shares. It's still below the peak, and that was a bubbly peak back in 2000. It just about approximated it again in 2007, and we're not so far away from the 450 point level. If you add back in the rest of Europe, so that's obviously including the UK, Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, then we can see that it is a lot closer to the upper side of this range. There is, I think, a realistic possibility that if the credit impulse is starting to turn the corner in Europe, then a lot of bad news is already in the shares. And what we are now starting to see is that some of the peripheral markets are appreciating. Greece in particular having benefited from euros of debt forgiveness has been rallying. That's been quite this it's been a quite similar rally we've seen in Italy. That's despite the fact that Italy is still paying a bit more for its debt than just about everyone else in the Eurozone. But the Italian index has been rallying pretty persistently since the beginning of this year. We have to look at a lot more history to really get a perspective that this index has been in a base formation since 2009. This is a decade-long range, and within the range there is a progression of higher reaction lows. And it's within the base formation that we often hear of dire forecasts that are not realized. And there are a very large number of dire forecasts being made about Italy and its populist government. But one thing that we've seen is the realpolitik of the Eurozone is that these populist uprisings have in large part been neutered because they look at the chasm that is represented by the fiscal deficits that they want to instigate and what that would do to their government bond yields, and they have to a man walked back from that. And that's all part of the continued drive towards fiscal union and the potential for Europe to in fact become a federal state after 2030, because the austerity program is going to persist until at least that time, because they want to equalize the debt to GDP ratios. But this does look like a base formation. I think that's one of the most important things out there. When we think about the markets and the globe in terms of the performance of markets, there just aren't that many base formations out there. And for example, the Spanish market has been ranging above the 8,000 level for most of the last decade. So we have a similar condition there. Then it's a very similar condition with Portugal as well. And these are some of the most indebted markets. Well, if we're thinking about value and we're thinking about the potential for things to get better, well, Europe is very much out there on the hinterland of what people are interested in, and therefore it is perhaps time to start getting somewhat more interested in it. Well, another reason why central bank balance sheets have been contracting is because the euro has been weak, and it is now down to about 112.5, and then when we think about this, it's paused at 116, 115, 114, and now again 113. There was a break in that sequence in March, but now it has been reasserted. Well, that suggests that the 112 area is not going to hold indefinitely. The additional reason why we've had a contraction in balance sheets has been because of the strength of the renminbi. And that has also been able to, the fact that the renminbi has been strong, but not in a particularly dynamic manner, strengthening by from 7 to 6.75 is not an especially large appreciation. And the fact that they are more pushing the fiscal side than the quantitative easing side is an additional signal here that they have learned some of the lessons from quantitative easing and are adopting more of the fiscal largesse. That's, I think, a very significant change that we're seeing now. Well, the very the fact that we have a very strong fiscal impetus in China has been a clear tailwind for the stock market. But we know that bull markets in China are state-directed. This does look like another bullish phase, and it's coming off of reasonably low levels. In fact, the index had been right in the region of the upper side of the previous base as recently as January. And we're probably going to see additional upside in here, not least because it's a negotiating tool. To be able to demonstrate that the stock market and industrial production can pick up in the face of negotiations on the trade war with the USA is obviously a negotiating tactic, as well as the fact that there are significant challenges in terms of delivering a really healthy economy this year when there are so many very important anniversaries. But what we can anticipate from the longer term with China is that they are looking at becoming the global hegemon. And that represents a massive investment in technological innovation. The one thing that China has to do if they're going to achieve that goal is to escape the middle-income trap. And in order to do that, well, they're not going to do it with demographics. Within the next 30 years, China is going to lose about 200 million workers. At the same time, India is going to gain about 200 million workers. We're already starting to see that manufacturing capacity is migrating, and there's a simple reason for that. It's because India has got millions and millions of young, ambitious workers that need jobs. And the simple fact of the matter is China doesn't. And the people that it has, well, on the one hand, it is trying to ensure that it can deliver modest improvements in living standards while holding on to power. At the same time, they need to invest in technological innovation to improve per capita production, because with fewer people in their prime working ages, then each of those people has to become more productive. So that means they are investing heavily in technology and robotics. They're also investing in genetics, and that's something that is very clearly a major consideration in what's going on in China right now. What they're doing is, if we think about CRISPR alone, CRISPR was invented about 7 years ago. It was in 2014 and 15 that China first started experimenting on it, on people with it. And it was really only this week that the USA officially started to deploy CRISPR in human beings. So that's just about 5 years behind. And they potentially look on the kind of ethical considerations that have taken so much time to work through in the West as a sign of weakness. And that's, I think, a very significant issue. They are deploying just about every potential tool in order to boost economic development. And the rest of the world is not really paying that much attention. That suggests that China is going to continue to advance, but it's probably going to be in a rather barbaric fashion, particularly when we look at the kinds of initiatives that are being put in place to control the population. We already have quite a lot of evidence of that. Well, against that background, where we think about the trajectory of governance, well, what that suggests is that China for the long term is going to be a trading opportunity rather than an investment opportunity. Whereas India, with better governance, is likely to be a much more steady source of appreciation in terms of stock market performance. And we have evidence of that already. Well, the Nifty already is at a new high, and it is due some consolidation. But this continues to look like a secular bull market. Modi Care, and I'm going to post an article about it in here today, is a good news story. It's the kind of good news story that improves perceptions that India probably can start to address some of the most intransigent problems that it has. And what I found most particularly interesting about it is that there was a distinct absence of those kinds of feel-good stories at 5 years ago. And that's where the real change has occurred. If we look at the kind of performance we've seen in the stock market over the course of the last 5 years, then the market has just about doubled. And that's a really pretty impressive performance. Now, the much bigger question is what's going to happen with the rupee over the long term? Because one of the factors that has contributed to rupee weakness over all this time has been the fact that there has been a balance of payments deficit. If India gets manufacturing, then that's going to change all that, and we could start to see a stronger currency. Well, if we then start to get a stock market that can perform, the potential for governance to improve, and a stronger currency, then it's going to be very difficult to argue against India becoming a much more substantial investment destination. And it is currently a fraction of the size of China in terms of its performance. Well, then we should think about what's going on Wall Street, because it continues to be led higher by its mega cap sector. And we have had a substantial pause over the course of the last 15 months. When we look at the size of the move we've had off the lows in December, then we're due consolidation. There's really very little argument for that, in especially when we see that there has been a significant pause already over the last week in the region of the peak from back in September. It's certainly not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we do get some additional consolidation. When we look at the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, though, then that generally does tend to be a lead indicator, and it has broken out in very emphatic fashion over the last 2 to 3 weeks. That suggests that we could be in for an additional leg on the upside for this market. There has been a great deal of angst among investors about an inverted yield curve, but the classic yield curve, which is the difference between the 10 and the 2-year, has not inverted. And that suggests that we are late in the cycle, but we're not at the end of the cycle. In fact, it is usually when the yield curve starts to steepen in a really alarming manner that is usually when we start to see markets pulling back sharply. The yield curve tends to offer a very long lead. It's usually by the time that people have forgotten about it is when they really should be remembering it. And we do tend to see that markets have an additional leg on the upside and can rally as much as 20 or 30% before they eventually start to roll over. The fact that a cyclical sector like the semiconductors index is starting to do better, well, that's I think that's a bullish indication. The fact that we are starting to see the credit impulse starting to pick up again, that's also quite positive. The much more important consideration is that the Federal Reserve is no longer raising interest rates. As long as that remains the case, and it is quite likely that they are going to remain on hold until after the presidential election in 2020, well, then that suggests that there is also potential scope here for additional upside. I also want to continue to highlight the fact that we are in the third year of the presidential cycle, and it's usually from the latter half of the third year through to the presidential election that we tend to see the market do particularly well. The last year and a half of the four-year cycle tends to be the best part of it. It's also usually, in terms of the rationale behind the cycle, when the Federal Reserve starts to pause and it starts to become a little bit easier in terms of monetary policy to give the incumbent a better chance of winning the election. There's certainly nothing written in stone about that, but it has been the pattern that we've seen over the course of the last 60 or 70 years, and it is irrespective of who is in the White House. Well, what that also suggests is that there is the potential for an additional leg on the upside in here. When we think about the much longer term and think about The Dow gold ratio. Well, there are approximately 35 years between the peaks, and each one of those peaks has been higher than the last. And we are, if the last peak was in 1999, then the next peak will probably not be until the mid-2030s. And that would suggest that we're only about halfway through this secular bull market, and that there is potentially another 15 or 16 years on the upside. Well, I'm certainly not predicting that we're going to go that length of time without seeing a recession, but in secular bull markets, recessions tend to be less violent than during secular bear markets. I think that's the one thing that everyone is terrified by, and it is perhaps going to be one of the factors that is most surprising in terms of this cycle. The one thing that everyone is worried about is the potential for bond investors to go on strike when we next have a recession. But if we think about what we are in fact seeing, there isn't a great deal of evidence to support that. And one of the reasons behind that is demographics. That we have, there's a very clear correlation between the median age of a population and the government bond yield. And as the population ages, then bond yields do tend to compress. So naturally, if the oldest populations are in Japan and Germany, then they have the lowest bond yields. The UK and the USA are pretty similar, and of course places like India and South Africa are way out on the other side of the spectrum. That potentially suggests that we're going to have yields contained for the foreseeable future. There is also the possibility that in a crisis we could see that the bond market could start to get bought up by the central bank in much the same way that Japan has done, and that would keep yields lower for longer too. But those are prognostications. And the other big question that people have been asking is, well, what happens if they do try to cut interest rates and they run out of space? And that then you will get to a point where they're pushing on the proverbial string. And there is that certainly as a possibility, but that only opens up the door to further, even more extraordinary sets of monetary policy. So I tend to think that this is a very significant issue. Most particularly, if we just simply look at the way that the market has been trading, we had a failed break above 3%. And now the yield is trending downwards. And it has encountered resistance this week in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. If we get downside follow through next week, well, then that will confirm a low of at least near-term significance in terms of the 10-year government bond. And this looks like a bullish chart. When we look at government bond prices, then it has broken the downtrend. It's found support in the region of the trend mean. It's rallied again. It's now finding support in the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range. This is an uptrend, and that really is suggestive of additional upside here. So the bond market is pricing in that growth is going to moderate, that the best place to be is going to be in bonds, that there is no prospect of the Federal Reserve raising rates, that we are at the top of the interest rate cycle, and that this is a very clear hedge. And I think that's what the bond market is pricing in. And we really do need to listen to people in the bond markets, because they generally are better at predicting the economic outlook than the stock market is. So I think we are at a rather important point here, because the bond markets are positioning for an economic slowdown. Central banks are positioning themselves because they're afraid of a slowdown, and governments are starting to print money because they're trying to arrest a slowdown. The stock market is pricing all of that in and saying, well, then that's great for asset prices. So that's the condition that we're in right now. Then we have the fact that when we think about the very long term, that when oil prices range, then stock markets rally, and vice versa. And we're most definitely in a range for oil prices. Now, oil has been firm over the course of the last few months, but it is much more likely to range than trend over the course of the next few decades. And what that suggests is that it's going to remove a tax from consumers over the very long term. If we start to also think about what the very significant moves that we had this week in the healthcare sector, I'm of the opinion that the kinds of moves we're seeing in the healthcare sector are a much bigger problem than people are, I think, really willing to countenance at these levels. There's been a marked loss of consistency over the course of the last 6 months. It's been very easy for pharmaceutical companies to project in a linear fashion, but the way that something that I've noticed in markets over the course of the last 20 and 30 years is that when something has persisted for an awfully long time and people think of it as going to persist forever, then that's usually when it ends. And pharmaceutical companies have been rubbing their hands together at the prospect of an aging population that they'll be able to milk for profits for the foreseeable future because of the baby boomers nearing the ends of their lives. And that there is a rebellion growing against that, but then the clear, I guess, the oldest adage in the commodity markets is the cure for high prices is high prices. And pharmaceutical prices are most definitely high. And there are two ways that high prices get changed. The first is competition. Well, the competition on this instance is coming from genetics. The kinds of genetic solutions that are getting permissioned right now are for rare diseases because they are an unmet need. And that means they get permissioned much faster. But genetic solutions are equally viable in chronic conditions. And the pharmaceutical business relies on chronic conditions, particularly like diabetes or, for example, arthritis. And those kinds of diseases can be tackled with genetic solutions. It's only a matter of time before that, in fact, happens. And the beautiful, modelable cash flows that pharmaceuticals have will then evaporate. Then that is also the reason why a large number of pharmaceutical companies are concentrating much more on psychiatric drugs, because psychiatrics is a much more subjective diagnosis. It's obviously much more difficult to treat from a genetic perspective. That is their hedge against the rise of the competition from genetics, but then also they would probably have less competition in terms of the drug pricing wars that are likely to become a political football for the foreseeable future. And not least because all those baby boomers on whose cash flows they rely on vote. This is, I think, a very significant issue for the healthcare sector. And what that suggests is that I think investors need to be particularly alert to the kinds of threats that can arise, and also to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends and the reliability of dividends. And that is also something that has been a factor in this market over the course of the last decade, that obsolescence has been a very clear trend, and I think that is going to persist practically indefinitely. Then if we are in a point where we're late in the cycle but not at the end of the cycle, then we need to be alert to the kinds of things that coincide with the end of the cycle. Well, the first would be high yield spreads starting to rise, but that is not happening. In fact, high yield spreads have been contracting, and particularly so this week. So that is removing a source of angst from the market. Then when we look at unemployment, then that's obviously at least a coincident indicator, because you can't very well have a recession without people losing their jobs. But we also know that we're at full employment. So that is a potential, or I guess that is something that we need to pay particular attention to. When that starts to trend higher, then we're almost certainly going to have a recession. One thing I find particularly interesting is that when we look at companies like Lyft, well, this is an example of a group of companies that have survived now for more than a decade, but they don't make any profits. And they're a long way from making any profits. And it is quite likely that they will never make any profits. They don't have any workers either, but they do have contractors. And those contractors do pay Social Security as for themselves. And if they declare themselves to be unemployed, then they will start to collect some form of benefit. So they don't show up in terms of workers for these companies. But if these companies start to experience a contraction, then their drivers being unemployed will then become a very significant source of potentially unemployed people, and they have millions of drivers. If we're thinking about the kinds of things that could be potentially disruptive, both in terms of technological disinflation and technological innovation, well, Google's Waymo service has now made its Waymo app available on the Google App Store. So that's a very significant step forward. They're going to start making it publicly available in Phoenix, and then they will start to roll it out from there. I rather think that we are a lot closer to autonomous vehicles than a lot of others think, that it's probably going to happen within the next 5 years, and that within 10 years, there probably won't be cars that we drive ourselves, not least because insurance rates would spike when humans are deemed to be much more of a risk than an autonomous vehicle. And that's something that is not really represented in Google's price now, but Waymo is the clear leader in terms of delivering these kinds of solutions. If we think about the kinds of secular bull markets that have evolved over the course of the last 100 years, they've been driven by technological innovation, and massive technological innovation at that. And autonomous vehicles and biotechnology both represent very significant trends that have the potential to transform the world. On top of that, you have the rise of the global consumer, most particularly with improving standards of governance in India and in Africa. Those are the major new population centers. That's where all the young people are. And that's where you have the real source of potential productivity growth. Well, that's also then where we're going to see the highest growth rates over the course of the next 30 years. And then we have the energy sector. Well, unconventional oil and gas has been a massive game changer, and that remains the case. Not only has it turned the USA from being the biggest importer to being the biggest exporter, it has upended the geopolitical balance. But in addition to that, it is very easy to forget that natural gas has been incredibly prolific in terms of production. And the natural gas price is coming down aggressively at the present moment. Part of the reason for that is because the LNG price in Asia has been contracting, and that's because Australia is also now a major exporter. And It's looking increasingly likely that we're going to get a global price, that the Henry Hub price in the USA is now representative of the global market because of US exports. And this is really a very depressed looking market where there is ample additional new supply coming online all the time. Well, that also holds out the prospect for the development of a hydrogen economy, because hydrogen can be reformed from natural gas. And we are already starting to see that some of the auto companies have got hydrogen fuel cell vehicles on the road. Hydrogen fuel cells can also be used as range extenders for electric vehicles, and there are haulage vehicles being produced as hydrogen vehicles. So there is the real potential that we're going to have a hydrogen fuel cycle evolve out of the prolific source of natural gas that's been delivered. And then you have fusion technology, which is, well, at least 5 years ago, it was always 25 years away. Well, now it's less than 10 years away. It might be less than 10 years away for another 10 years, but it is certainly improving, and there are innovations being developed all the time. The application of artificial intelligence to fusion technology is a completely new parameter, and they are starting to solve some of the very big problems that containing plasma is so much like the sun that it creates solar flares, and that makes the loop of plasma unstable. There are artificial intelligence computer models that have been trying to figure out how to contain that, and they've been largely successful. That has greatly reduced the amount of time that's required to get through these various iterations. These are all incredibly powerful bullish phenomena that have the capacity, as just as individual themes, to drive a secular bull market. So that, I think, is the most important long-term consideration, that there is ample potential for secular bull markets to persist, despite the fact that there is always going to be something to worry about. We are going to get a recession at some point, but it's probably going to be a milder recession than the kinds of things we've seen over the last 15 years. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'd wish a happy Easter to all of you.